Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome to The Mark Steiner Show and Soundbites, our weekly look at food, farming, and our environment. You're listening to us here on WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community, and on Marvel Public Radio, WSDL 90.7 FM, and WSCL 89.5 FM. And during this hour, we're going to be looking at the question of pesticides in the human brain, especially developmental brain and pregnant women. We're going to be looking at the black liquor bill that failed in the House here in Maryland. Get an update on environmental issues in the state legislature for Tim Wheeler. But we're going to begin by discussing a debate taking place now, or at least a hearing taking place now, in the House of Delegates in Annapolis as we speak, about GMO labeling. Should we have our food labeled, saying whether it has genetically modified organisms in it or not? We are here with Colin O'Neill, Director of Government Affairs for the Center for Food Safety, and Colby Ferguson, Director of Government Relations for the Maryland Farm Bureau. Colin and Colby, welcome. Good to have you both with us.
Good morning. Thanks for having us.
Great to have you both. And join us here at 410-319-8888 with your thoughts and ideas. Write to us at steinershow@gmail.com. You can log on to our Facebook pages or just tweet me at Mark Steiner, 410-319-8888. So here we are, and this bill is kind of – it's having a hearing now. It's winding its way through here. We're almost at the end of the session. And Colin, let me begin, since the bill is introduced, I know, by Senator Karen Montgomery and others. And talk about why you're arguing for the bill, and then we'll go to Colby.
Sure. Well, Mark, as you covered before, the issue of labeling of genetically engineered foods is widely popular across the country and internationally. 64 countries around the world require the mandatory labeling of foods produced through genetic engineering. Last year, 26 states introduced over 50 bills to require the mandatory labeling of GE foods, and two states, Connecticut and Maine, passed labeling laws. However, their bills have trigger clauses, meaning they don't go into effect until a number of other states in the Northeast also compel labeling.
But there's no trigger clause in this bill.
There is no trigger clause in this bill. And in the absence of federal leadership, we've seen the FDA, time after time upon request, fail to require the mandatory labeling of genetically engineered foods and really revisit its outdated labeling policy. And so in the absence of this federal leadership, states like Maryland can and should enact their own labeling laws.
So Colby Ferguson, good to have you with us as well, Maryland Farm Bureau. Tell us why this is being opposed by the Farm Bureau and others.
Well, primarily, I think, we really do see this as obviously a regional or actually a national thing, particularly when you start talking about specifically with Maryland being one of only one of three states and actually would be the only state that would actually enact a labeling law that would pretty much just alienate the Maryland manufacturers and the state of Maryland into requiring this label where the rest of the United States would not have to. And when you have roughly 75% or more of the packaged products that are being requested on this this bill be labeled, with over 75% of those being grown or being produced outside of the state of Maryland, being manufactured, I should say, then you're requesting a state law to for interstate commerce. And we, a couple of things that go into that, whether that would even be legal or not, and whether it would hold up in federal court, and most likely there would be entities from outside of the state of Maryland that would actually probably file lawsuits against this, against the state of Maryland, to hold it up in federal court, which we don't believe is probably the right way to go, and that if it was going to be needing to be labeled, that it probably should be done on a national level.
So, I mean, go ahead, Colin, because I think this is an issue that is a serious issue. I mean, let's say for argument's sake it passed. Mm-hmm. I mean, how would AU enforce it with businesses in Minnesota and California and New York selling products here? How would that even take place? And could it be deemed illegal?
Sure. So first, I'll say that HB 1191, the bill that Delegate Kelly introduced in the House and the companion bill in the Senate by Senator Montgomery, is a well-supported and carefully crafted initiative that comports well with both Maryland state and federal law, and after it is enacted, we feel confident they will not be susceptible to successful legal challenges.
Why do you think that? The anti-GMO labeling movement in this country to stop legislation in California, Washington, Oregon, other places, I mean, have been successful, and part of it has been built around the illegality of going across state lines.
So, you know, in what we saw in our experiences in California and Washington State is unique because the opponents put in over $65 million between those two states to oppose labeling, outspending the supporters of labeling by large margins. And really the tactics we saw were not to oppose labeling, but to confuse consumers, say, and really what we saw is that after the votes were in, even those who supported or who opposed labeling actually support labeling at the federal level or would support it in the future, but were just confused by all the advertising by the opponent side. Now, we know that Maryland can compel the labeling of foods produced through genetic engineering because it is a factual disclosure that's reasonably related to legitimate public health, environmental, and economic state interests. And we also know that it's in harmony with the Dormant Commerce Clause because states can regulate articles in interstate commerce so long as they do not discriminate against out-of-state interests. Because this wouldn't discriminate against one specific state, and we know that all of these major food corporations are marketing and labeling their products in 64 other countries around the world. We know that companies can do this.
Okay,
There's no reason that Maryland can't compel this.
So, Colin O'Neill, let me ask you to respond to that, but also, let's start with that, and I have another question for you, but let's start with that.
Am I Colby? I think there's a couple of things that go into that. This issue that I keep continuing to hear that there's health issues. I guess that's probably one of the biggest misconceptions that comes from genetically modified foods, particularly the products that are being requested in this, which are basically off of the eight known crops that are legal to be genetically modified in the state, and from that only about a half a dozen products are being produced that are in those mass use things, such as high fructose corn syrup, refined sugars from sugar beets, and then also your soybean oils and your cottonseed oils. And I guess the biggest thing that you get into when there's no scientific proof, there's no valid scientific data that's shown that there is any health issues. There's just mainly anecdotal, maybe opinion poll and anecdotal data out there. When you look at the First Amendment, that's really where this comes down to. You know, it says First Amendment does provide protections that, that can and cannot be mandated in terms of labeling. So if a state government wants to compel a label, it has to have substantial interest to require that label. And those types of things are consumer health and safety. But when people want to have just the right to know under federal law, the right to know argument is not appealing or won't hold up in court. And that's really where we're at. There's just no... If there was issues with the health, the FDA and USDA, which are the main agencies and entities that all of these products have to go through, they would mandate. There's federal laws that mandate if there's any health issues, whether it be allergens or whatever, it's law that they must be labeled. But in this case, there is no proof, there is no scientific data that shows that there's anything that FDA and USDA considers to be unhealthy or potentially hazardous to the human health, and that's why they have not moved forward with.
So I'm going to let Colin come back and respond to that, but let me just ask this quick question, Colby. I'm going to go to the phones and then let Colin come back, because Baki, you're the first caller up. We're going to come to your phone call here in just a second, but just in terms of how this country thinks of itself and how citizens think of themselves, don't people have the right to know what's in their food? And you mentioned fructose, soy, and sugar, refined sugar. Well, that's most of our food.
Right. Yeah, it's predicted to be over 70% of the
right.
products.
So don't people have a right to know whether or not there's a GMO, whether we know or don't know, one can argue this, but what genetically modified foods do or do not do to us, or do to our fields, or do to the soil or whatever else. Don't we have a right to know what's in it?
Well, I mean, I certainly understand the argument where everybody is coming from as far as that they want to know. or more importantly, maybe not what they want to know, but they want to know what, you know, they want to be able to, if they want to purchase a product, they can get one that doesn't have any genetic modified products in it, and they already have that option. There is a federal law out there that does allow you, that does allow companies that don't want to use GMO products to be able to label them GMO-free. And then USDA certified organic is mandatory that there be no genetic modified products in those. So there's two options right there that are out there. Now, the wanting to know, I mean, I there's lots of things I would like to know what's out there. But
we're talking about the food we ingest into our bodies and our children's bodies, though.
Yeah, but if it's been studied for 13 years and all the money, and we've had them for 20 years, but it takes 13 years to go through the process to verify and validate that there's no issues with it. I guess my biggest thing is we're trying to put what I see is there's trying to be a label put out there that is going to give a negative connotation that GMOs are actually bad for you, when there's no scientific, there's nothing that validates that, and it actually is going to be the future of agriculture. And if we're going to continue to feed the population that's shortly to go to 9 billion people on much significantly less land, we're going to need these types of products and these types of crops to be able to have the diversity and the ability to
So, Colin, given the time we have, Colby, hold on, I'll let you come right back, but I do want to get a call in here that I think is related to the question I wanted to ask you and what Colin was just saying. I'll let you respond, all right? 410-319-8888, and Baki, you're on the air.
My name is Baki.
I'm sorry. Oh, Baki, I'm sorry. I said Baki on my screen.
God bless you. Yeah. Well, first of all, thank you for having this discussion, and even having the discussion that preceded this with Kwame Ture. And maybe we'll have a larger forum discussing him and his life also. But one of the things, and how activists like him and Ben Chavis and Damu Smith, my good friend, who's with the Angels, all of them, how, and they said Ben Chavis, you know, Ben Muhammad, you know, how all of them were active in the environmental and health issues also, as they said, we must be organized. What I wanted to say is that it is good that we have experts like this on, and we need additional experts, because my man keeps quoting with no scientific information. At Morgan State University, we have scientists and biologists and all kinds of engineers and all kinds of persons at colleges, all historical black colleges all over this country and also around the diaspora, that are studying these things just like third world people, or I should say first world people in India and other places. And this thing not only impacts communities like I live in the urban cities, where food is forced and is canned and pre-processed and you name it, and it's outdated and expiration dates and the like. And so it's no question when we talk about how do GMOs impact us, you know, it has devastating impact when we don't know what's in the food and we see youngsters walking around prematurely overweight and prematurely oversexed and all those other things because of the stuff that's in the food. And it also has impact on their learning capabilities and the like.
Right.
And so thank you for having the community participate in this discussion, because there's no question people like Senator Joan Carter Conway, who's the chairperson of Health, Education, and Environmental Affairs, has always been on these issues, and I pray that whatever comes out of the House complements something positive in the Senate, so we come out with a comprehensive bill. The last thing I would say is this.
Yeah, because we only have like 5 minutes left in the segment. I need to get back to our guests here.
That's fine. Well, we do that all the time, Mark. We listen to the guests all the time, and very rarely do we get enough people because of the community.
I don't think that's true, Ducky, but anyway, I finish what you're saying so I get back to let Colby respond to what Colin was saying, but go ahead, Ducky.
Because I feel that very strong. Having said that, what I'm saying is that when we talk about the element of the law, black people referred to as chattel in interstate commerce, right? We talk about interstate commerce until six women from Union Baptist Church sued, you know, the steamer suitcase and took it to the Supreme Court and won in 1883. We were referred to as chattel in interstate commerce. So we talk about commodities across state line and state rights. I mean, let's look at the historical reference.
Okay, right? Hold on, Ducky. Let me just let Colby respond to what Colin said. And I think this next segment coming up after this is also relating to what you're saying. Colby, I'd like you to respond. You hear what Ducky was saying. Respond to what Colin was saying.
What do you want? I mean, Colby, I'm the one from Farm Bureau. You want?
I mean,
me
I'm sorry. I keep getting this, my C's mixed up. I mean, Colin O'Neill.
So, Mark, you know, as opponents will argue that Maryland can't compel labeling of GE foods because they're not dangerous. But
in the U.S., we don't label dangerous foods. We take them off the marketplace. In actuality, mandatory labeling provides material information to consumers. We know that consistently in public opinion polls, over 90% of consumers want this information. And it's a vital public health tool to allow Maryland health practitioners to track any unintended health effects. That's very different than saying that these foods are dangerous. Our side is not arguing that these foods are dangerous, but in the event of unintended health effects, Maryland health practitioners should be able to track those. This is the same type of labeling that would be required for things like orange juice from concentrate or whether food has been irradiated. The FDA requires the labeling of nearly 4,000 ingredients, additives, and processes. Unfortunately, genetically engineered foods just seems to be the glaring outlier.
So what are the chances this bill is going to pass?
Well, we feel confident that the House HGO committee this afternoon, is gonna support this bill. We're looking forward to the questions that they're gonna be asking. But Maryland has long taken up the mantle of consumer environmental protection, and we feel that this would be yet another accolade for Maryland to take the step and push the federal government to finally require the mandatory labeling. If Maryland moves first, the feds will move second, and that's how we get mandatory labeling across the country.
A quick caller in here, then we'll go back to Colin before we have to take a break. 410-319-8888. Olu, you're on the air.
Hi, I'm calling. Sorry, I have a call. I wanted to ask about the gentleman against labeling mentioned that you can label it non-GMO or organic, which seems to put a lot of financial pressure on those that are trying to provide the consumers who want those things. Like, it's pretty difficult and requires a lot of, regulations to be considered those things, and it puts the financial pressure on the smaller people who are trying to provide that. I don't know if anybody has anything thinking about addressing that, or if the federal could kind of, give some support. As well as my experience is also outside of this country, I work very hard to get non-GMO seeds, for example, and our crops grow really well in Ghana, whereas some of our neighbors who use the GMO products, including, the Roundup and everything, the chemicals, if they don't use the products from the company, their crops don't grow. It looks terrible. So it seems like that a lot of this is about capitalism as opposed to trying to provide a service to the people of the world and their food. It just seems like not labeling it as it might hurt the GMO people's feelings. The people have a right to know, and it might suggest that there's something wrong with it. That doesn't seem like, I don't understand how that's a valid argument or even a legal argument. I don't know.
Olu, I appreciate the thoughts and the call. Thank you so much for being part of the show. Let me go to Colby quickly and then Colin quickly in the last couple of minutes that we have left in the segment. Colby can respond, and I have one last thought for Colin. Please go ahead.
Well, basically the I think the whole factor of this is getting back to I firmly believe that there's a ton of misconceptions in the genetically modified crops such as BT corn and Roundup Ready soybeans are bad for the environment, bad for the economy, bad for human health. And that's so far from the truth, it's just unbelievable. And it's very unfortunate that we don't have more time to kind of get into the specifics on that and discuss about what this bill would actually do and how this would really harm the Maryland manufacturers, the small guys in Maryland, not the big guys, not the Coke companies, and not the ones that are internationally, but the guys that are small that now will have to be putting in this regulation, the farmers that will be negatively looked at because they're using GMO products, and even though they're more environmentally friendly, able to use 60% less chemicals and are cleaning up the bay and doing everything they can to be better stewards of the land, and it's just unfortunate with that.
And Colin O'Neill, please respond very quickly. We only have less than a minute left to this.
Sure.
To this question about health or not health, the environment, and other issues.
While we debate the human health and environmental impacts of genetically engineered crops, For the past 20 years, FDA has not allowed consumers the ability to choose in the marketplace. That's what this really is all about. You know, the food industry spends over $1 trillion every year on food marketing. If the food industry wants to convince consumers to buy genetically engineered foods, I'm sure they'd be able to spend the money to do so. In the meantime, we feel that consumers have a fundamental right to know. Voluntary labeling, even marketing claims like non-GMO, will not provide consumers with the full universe of information that they rightfully deserve. Furthermore, it doesn't matter where you shop and what technology you have, everyone should be afforded the basic right to know about what the foods they are they're buying and feeding their families. And that's the fundamental issue here. This doesn't increase cost to consumers. There's no new burden for farmers. It's really common sense, as we've seen the 64 other countries around the world enact mandatory labeling. It's high time that Maryland take the first step.
Colin O'Neill is Director of Government Affairs for the Center for Food Safety, and Colby Ferguson, Director of Government Relations for the Maryland Farm Bureau. Thank you both so much, and I'm sorry I kept mixing up your names. Good to have you both with us in this segment of Soundbites in the Mark Steiner Show.
Thanks, Mark.
Thank you.
Take care. We're going to take a brief, very brief break, and when we return, we're back here with Tim Wheeler, a reporter for Be More Green, the Baltimore Sun's environmental blog, to look at other legislation in the House and Senate of Maryland and where it is and what they've done and what they haven't done. Welcome back to the Mark Steiner Show and Soundbites here on WEAA 80.9 FM, the voice of the community, and Delmarva Public Radio, WSDL 90.7 FM and WSCL 89.5 FM. We're about to talk to Tim Wheeler, reporter for Be More Green, the Baltimore Sun's environmental blog. Tim, welcome back.
Good morning, Mark.
How are you?
I'm here.
Well, that's good enough.
Sometimes that's all you can say.
Well, it's good to have you with us. Let's begin by... This whole phosphorus regulation issue. I mean, here was something that we covered a lot over the last several years, and it was put in. It was a regulation was supposed to go into effect to minimize the amount of phosphorus coming off of farmlands because it stays in the soil, and if you don't do it now, it could last for years. But the opposition was pretty fierce and seems to have blunted the regulation, despite the science that came out ahead.
Well, the Department of Agriculture, as you know, at least twice, I guess technically three times, proposed these regulations and withdrew them each time.
Right.
And their last salvo, I guess, in the fall, they said they were going to issue them this year, and the game plan was to phase them in response to concerns from growers and the poultry industry that it was going to have a really disruptive and, potentially devastating impact on the poultry industry on the Delmarva Peninsula. So they were planning to do it over a few years. The concerns continued, however, and the agriculture community came to Annapolis, and there was legislation introduced in the House and the Senate that would require, an economic impact analysis be done before these regulations could be adopted. Those bills haven't moved anywhere, but the same basic point was inserted into the budget legislation that the General Assembly is required to pass to sort of basically set the spending priorities for the state for the coming year in the Senate. It was done, I guess, proposed by Senator Jim Mathias from the Lower Shore, but it clearly had the support of the Senate leadership. Senate President Mike Miller said, in essence, that either it was going to be done in the budget or they would move the legislation.
So I'm curious. This also, we're looking at the pesticide bill is now that may get this further study, right, that you wrote about.
Yeah.
Both these things speak to me on one level. I'll just talk about a bit, if you talk about the politics behind both this kind of look at the regulation of pesticides and what pesticides do to health and the environment or not, and the question of phosphorus in the Bay, 26% come from agriculture, but many other sources as well, runoff from our lawns and everything else. But why do you think it is so difficult to get any momentum on any of this legislation ever, it seems. They're always stymied. They're always sent back for a further study. What's the politics here behind all this?
Well, the naturally, the poultry industry is and the agriculture community quite protective of what they have. There's a perception in that community that they're overregulated and that they are unfairly blamed for for pollution of the Chesapeake Bay and other environmental harms. On the pesticide front, there was a tiny step appears to be about to be made in that. The bills that would essentially raise the fees for pesticide registration by $10 a year, I believe, to help pay for the Department of Agriculture to gather more information on pesticide use in the state has have moved in both chambers, and appears that there's no real opposition to it. That's a far step from what the environmental community would like to have. They want to have mandatory reporting, and that's been a subject of a somewhat fractious study group for over a year now.
So we're going to have a very brief break and come back, Tim. I want to pursue this a bit more with you and what these bills mean or don't mean. I mean, not mean or don't mean, but again, the politics behind them. Because I think, years of covering this, and you have been covering it for years too, I just want to probe this a little deeper. And we'll be right back with Tim Wheeler. Join us here at 410-319-8888 on the Mark Steiner Show and Soundbites. Don't go away. Welcome back. Here's the Mark Steiner Show and Soundbites on WEAFM and Delmarva Public Radio. We are continuing a conversation with Tim Wheeler, reporter for Be More Green, the Baltimore Sun's environmental blog. I mean, there's this constant battle and this war going on in the state legislature always between the environmental lobby and the agricultural lobby and the chemical industry lobby. And it just seems that whatever legislation always seems to be no matter which side you are on this, but stymied, blunted, not able to kind of really push through. Is that a fair assessment?
Yeah, I push and pull here. On the phosphorus regulations, interestingly enough, the environmental community, they're very uneasy about the idea of further delay, but there was not a big fight in the Senate floor over this budget language that would basically hold up the regulations until this economic study could be done. And in part, that's because the Department of Agriculture said they had already commissioned Salisbury University to do the study, and they were expecting that they would have it finished by the fall. So they could still hope to get the regulations in place by the end of the year and the end of Governor O'Malley's term. Obviously, with an election coming up and a new governor coming in, usually it's not clear what would happen at that point. But so there is some evidence there could be some progress there. The scientists, certainly with the University of Maryland, say there is more than ample reason for doing something about phosphorus in the soils.
So, and on the pesticide regulations, so there will be an extra tax on pesticides used in commercial areas and farms to fund the study. Is that what I read in your column?
Yes. Essentially to allow the department to gather more information. They had said basically they did not have a budget to really do much assessment of what information they already have, and so this would give them that extra funding. And, more information perhaps would help understand better the whether there's a problem and the nature of it. It's clear that there are some evidence in the environment of some impacts of toxics in the environment. What's not clear is exactly where they're coming from and how much of that could be attributed to farm chemicals.
Well, one last question to him is, so what are you looking at now? Is there anything else we're missing from what we've talked about today in terms of the environment and farming coming up in the next and food coming up in the next couple of days? We just talked about GMO labeling, and that's taking place today, but
yeah.
What else is going on?
Yeah, well, there's a lot of sort of renewable energy things happening here. One that that did just pass the House is a bill that would allow land that's already been preserved at taxpayer expense under the Agricultural Land Preservation Program to be used for renewable energy projects, primarily wind projects, but also perhaps anaerobic digestion of poultry litter. and possibly some small solar, though the size of the permitted acreage is so small it wouldn't really amount to much in terms of a solar project. It's about 5 acres, but that's enough to put, you know, at least a couple big commercial wind turbines on a farm. And from what I've been told, you could make $20,000-$30,000 a year per turbine on those.
Well, I want to thank you once again, Tim Wheeler, for taking the time with our listeners here. It's always great to have you on, a reporter for Be More Green, the Baltimore Sun's environmental blog. Take care, Tim.
Happy
reporting.
You too. Bye-bye.
Take care. We are now about to talk to Tommy Landers, who is the Maryland Policy Director for the Chesapeake Climate Action Network. Tommy, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
So this whole question of black liquor being defeated, that to me is kind of an unfortunate name because people have no idea what that means. I mean, I had to remember what it means. You know what I'm saying? So, but it was defeated. So talk a bit about what this really means, what it meant.
Sure, yeah. And I didn't know what black liquor meant either still a while ago. Yeah, so what we're talking about is, I mean, the state has a good goal of getting to at least 20% clean power by the year 2022. And, you know, we and some other folks are talking about raising that standard. But first, we need to make sure that the energy that counts as clean is actually clean. You know, because we still get over half of our energy from dirty sources, coal, oil, and gas, that's leading to climate change. And so we definitely need to transition to clean energy. And the question is, you know, what counts as clean? And so back in 2004, when Maryland passed this law, the Renewable Portfolio Standard, the whole point was to incentivize new clean power, like wind and solar. But unfortunately, it had this loophole in it. And the loophole deals with black liquor, which is a byproduct of making paper. And there's paper mills. There's one in Maryland, and there's a few others across the region, about 8 or 9, that have, for the past, you know, several decades, have been producing and then burning this black liquor for their own purposes. They use it as a kind of a recycling process and a little bit of electricity. And they, you know, have been getting Maryland clean energy subsidies for something they've been doing for decades. And we need to close that loophole.
But, I mean, what's amazing to me that more stink was not made of this by certain legislators. If we're talking about the X amount of money, whether it's $7 or $8 million or so, that is supposed to be used for clean energy, it's not being used for clean energy for solar and wind, but it's being used to pollute the atmosphere and the riverways to give us energy that didn't come from a clean source, right?
Right, right, that's right. And it's even more money than that. I mean, because this loophole is still there, over the next 10 years, we predict that we'd spend more than $20 million per year of Maryland ratepayer dollars going to these out-of-state paper mills. And it's definitely, you know, at least as dirty as coal, at least to the point of combustion, in terms of toxic chemicals, sulfur dioxide, particulates, and carbon. And it's got to go. And, I mean, in terms of support, the Senate, state Senate, passed this bill overwhelmingly last year with almost a 3-to-1 margin, and it came just one vote short in the House committee. And unfortunately, again, in that House committee is where it failed this year, but we're definitely looking forward to passing it soon.
Who chairs that committee?
Chairman Derek Davis, who did support the bill this year. He's from Prince George's County.
And so, very quickly, we only have about a minute left here. I'm curious why you think it failed in that committee.
Well, I think that it had, you know, the opposition from the national paper industry and national labor, who I think were looking out as much for the paper mills across the country as they were for the Maryland paper mill. And our bill protected the Maryland mill as much as humanly possible, but I think that's why it fell down this year.
Well, Tommy Landers, thanks so much. I'm glad you joined us here to kind of put that out there for our listeners to understand, and look forward to talking to you again soon, and thanks for the work you do.
All right, thank you.
Tommy Landers is Maryland Policy Director at the Chesapeake Climate Action Network. Reminding you here, the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you in part by the Maryland State Education Association. From school funding to Common Core, you can learn about the important issues affecting Maryland students, parents, and schools by visiting the Maryland State Education Association's website at marylandeducators.org. That's one word, marylandeducators.org, or go to our website and click on their banner. We're about to talk with Susan Frankel. She wrote this story for Food and Environment Reporting Network that appeared in The Nation magazine on their website. And she's a freelance journalist and author of the book Plastics, A Toxic Love Story. This particular article is called Warning Signs, How Pesticides Harm the Young Brain. And Susan, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Thank you for having me.
This is one of the stickiest subjects, I think, to not just report on, but to deal with scientifically and in terms of health, is making this linkage between pesticides and people's health, their neurological systems, our bodies. It's been one of the most taxing things, I think, to be able to kind of prove and figure out.
Yeah, I think it's really tough because, you know, it's not hard to see when there are really acute effects, you know, when somebody inhales or is exposed to like a pesticide and it makes them violently ill. But this is looking at these kind of subtle neurodevelopmental impacts, which kind of become apparent over a period of time. And it's very tough to identify them, to pin them down. And what's also hard is the kind of research that you need to get at them is really expensive and difficult to do, and we don't put a lot of money into it. So these studies are few and far between, unfortunately.
I've wondered about that a lot. In the years we've covered these kinds of things, people argue a great deal, and some of the people in your article we've had on this program, about the dangers of pesticides. But again, the medical research, finding that direct link, I mean, even the work of Chimakos, the group that you write about in the beginning of the article and through it, the Center for the Health Assessment and of Mothers and Children of Salinas, that did an incredibly important study. But even after all those years, being able to say this is the link is one of the reasons it's so tough to take on the chemical industry.
Right, because these are what they call observational studies. So in this study, Chimakos, the researchers were following this group of mothers and children from birth onward, and they're looking at the levels of pesticides the kids were exposed to while in the womb, and then looking at how the kids did over time. They can't say for sure this exposure caused this particular kid, for instance, to have ADD or to have a lower IQ, but they can say in general kids who had exposures above this level were at higher risk for these effects. Now, so that's not a direct cause and effect. On the other hand, these kinds of studies are sort of the gold standard for how you start to establish these links, and they're backed up by animal studies that show much more direct effects, cell studies that show a much more direct cause and effect. And, you know, classically, this is how the case, for instance, against tobacco was established, through animal studies and through these kinds of observational studies. And when you start to put all the pieces of evidence together, it's not a slam dunk, but it points out some pretty disturbing trends that at a certain point you can say, this isn't good. You know, this looks like this pesticide has a bad impact. But of course, that grain of uncertainty, the limits of what the data can tell you, is something that the chemical industry has always seized on to say, well, this is not establishing cause and effect. It's not. It's not meant to. It can't. But it can point to some pretty convincing associations.
So you see the work of people like Dr. Brenda Eskenazi, who runs Chimakos, as part of the building blocks that make a larger argument.
Yeah, I do. I mean, I think that they are accumulating evidence. And in the case of the pesticides that I talk about in this story, these organophosphate pesticides, the building blocks are coming from different directions. You have these kinds of studies that show an association that suggests that kids who are more heavily exposed in the womb are at higher risk of having these effects down the line. And you have really convincing animal studies showing effects. And there's a really plausible biological mechanism. We know that the chemicals used in this particular class of pesticides have this effect on the brain. You know, you put those pieces together, and it's a pretty convincing case.
The story you tell, starting with the beginning of the article, I mean, of the Mexican and Mexican-American women who are working in families, working in these fields, and what's happened to their children, clearly they're being deeply affected by the chemicals they work around on the edges of the field, in the field, when it's sprayed in their clothes, washing their babies in the water, all of it.
The women who are in this study, they're mostly Mexican immigrants. Some may be legal, some may not be illegal. They work in the fields. The woman who I talk about in the story, you know, she has a hard life. She gets up at like 3 or 4 in the morning to get everything ready, to get her young kids out the door, she and her husband, get them out, make lunches, get them dressed, get them out the door. Then they go and work in the fields all day, and they are surrounded by pesticides. They work around pesticides. In her case, she comes home and she lives right near a vineyard, so there's pesticides in the vineyard where they spray. And until she got involved in the study, she really didn't know any better but to use some pretty bad pesticides in her home. You know, one of the things that this study is showing is that, you know, it's not just that the women themselves get exposed in the fields, but they come home and they have, you know, pesticides on their clothes, pesticides on their hair, pesticides on their shoes, and that becomes a way to bring the pesticides back and for the kids to get exposed. And I know for this woman I interviewed for the story, it was sort of an eye-opener for her and her husband and a really upsetting discovery to think that they had been inadvertently exposing their kids because they didn't know any better.
I mean, you're right that there are roughly 90 million pounds of these organic phosphates were used annually nationwide at the time of the study that Chamaco started. And, I mean, the amount we use, even though it's been cut back, and we're using other chemicals now, as you write about, that they claim are not as bad, but the symptoms of their effect are still there.
Yeah, I mean, that's what we don't know. Like, again, the organophosphate pesticides that I wrote about, some of those are really persistent pesticides. And even though, like chlorpyrifos, which is kind of the big culprit in the story that I wrote, chlorpyrifos has been banned from residential use since, I think, 2000. But it's still used agriculturally, and it still drifts. And actually, in California, where I live, it's one of the top 10 pesticides found near schools. And it persists. It will stay. If it had been used in a home, it can still be found in a home for several years afterwards. You know, the other problem here is that we replace one pesticide with another, and we can't be sure because of sort of problems with regulatory framework for pesticides. We don't know. We can't be assured that the next one that comes along is going to be safe. And again, these studies that look at and try to really take apart is something safe take so long to do and are so hard to do that, you know, it's kind of like playing whack-a-mole.
You talk about one of the kind of scary aspects of this for people is the effect on not just children's behavior and some kids are being diagnosed with Asperger's, but IQ. And more and more, the issue is when you have large numbers of people whose IQ could be affected by the pesticides' effect on the developmental brain. This is one of the
The effects of these pesticides on the brain, the studies that looked at it, there's the study I write about in another set of studies in New York that followed kids who had been exposed through, like, basically they're urban kids who had been exposed through, like, cockroach sprays. And in both of those, all of those studies, they found that the kids' IQ, the kids who were most heavily exposed had, you know, as many as 7 IQ points lower than the less exposed kids. And, you know, that doesn't sound like such a big deal. 1 kid, 7 IQ points, no big deal. But then when you start looking at that at a population level, you're talking about huge numbers of people. The figures I've seen is that it could be like as much as a 50% increase in kids with sort of, you know, functionally disabled kids and a loss of, you know, untold numbers of potentially gifted adults. So it can have, and that, you know, then you're talking about, okay, 50% more disabled, intellectually disabled kids. What does that mean in terms of the demands on the school system? What does that mean in terms of the workforce that you have? So it has a pretty profound implication at a population level.
I mean, in part of the article, you come to this conclusion, the conclusion you've come to, that there are large numbers of women outside of Chamacos who are pregnant, who are found to have these kind of high concentrations of pesticides, pregnant women, and that this could lead to the idea that there could be large numbers of women in this country that are affected by pesticides, whether it's because of an apple you eat while you're pregnant or the kids consume. You know what I'm saying? I mean, that's...
Right. There's overlap. I mean, the biggest risk is to people like the women in the Chamaco study who are really kind of marinating in pesticides every day. But
that's an interesting choice of words,
true.
Marinating,
I mean,
there in
is,
pesticides.
I think the CDC biomonitoring study says something like 25% of women, pregnant women, have pesticides in their systems that are higher than the median level in the Chamaco group. So that is potentially, that doesn't mean all those people, all 25%, have levels that are necessarily going to be dangerous, but it speaks to an overlap that could be a big problem.
So, I mean, when you talk to obviously all these scientists across the country and people who are examining this that you interviewed for this article, and there is so much overlap in their studies in terms of what they're finding, how do you see this kind of, as you talk to other people, how does this kind of galvanize into kind of a movement, a kind of a national thought about this that may actually affect policy?
you know, I think there is growing awareness that about some of the more subtle impacts of pesticides, that it's not just, you know, gross birth defects, but it's this more subtle stuff. In California, there's a big push right now to try to get the California EPA to ban the remaining uses of chlorpyrifos, because it's one of the biggest, this is one of the places where it's most used. You know, a lot of the focus right now is not on pesticides, it's on the whole synthetic chemicals and efforts to reform the main law for synthetic chemicals. To be honest, I don't know a whole lot about where the pesticide push is outside of California.
But what you do right here is that 65% of the 16,000 pesticides the EPA is supposed to regulate from their internal report were approved on conditional registration, which means we don't know. Really don't know what's inside those pesticides. Really have no idea what's going on.
What it means is that, you know, these pesticides were, I don't know if it means that we don't have any idea what's going on, but, you know, they didn't get full vetting. They didn't get the vetting
right.
They should have gotten. The EPA has said that they're not going to use that as much. After that came out, they reduced the number of pesticides they were approving through conditional registration. So it's not as big a problem as it was in, I think, 2010 when that first came out. But, you know, there's a lot of gaps in the way the EPA regulates pesticides. There's no question about that. They're not looking sufficiently at, again, at these kinds of subtle neurodevelopmental impacts. They have only just gotten in place a screening process for endocrine-disrupting chemicals, including pesticides. So that whole body of science has been, you know, building for almost 20 years. So, you know, there are gaps in the way that we regulate pesticides.
It's interesting to me that when you were quoting Dr. Eskenazi and towards the end of your article, this is what I was just alluding to when we first began the conversation, Susan, when you quote her saying that to say you had 10 microliters per liter of PDBEs, what the hell does that mean? And what am I going to do with it? I mean, that's the frustration I'm talking about.
Right. I mean, all of us, and this isn't just about pesticides. This is about we live in a world, you know, we're swimming in a world of synthetic chemicals.
Right.
Pesticides, you know, plasticizers, different kinds of stuff in food packaging, fire retardants in our furniture, you know, antibacterial compounds in our clothes. I mean, there's just a lot of stuff that we're exposed to every day, and we don't have a very good system for making sure that it's all safe. We tend to treat a lot of these chemicals as innocent until proven guilty, and unfortunately, you know, the people who pay the price for that are our children, because they are the most vulnerable to these things. You know, that's a serious problem. That's not just pesticides. You know, in fact, pesticides are better regulated than a lot of these other chemicals, to be quite honest.
No, exactly. And I think one of the things, and you see also, again, the frustration of people trying to do their best to deal with this when you write about Jose Camacho, who is trying to get farm laborers to kind of think about their daily routine to cut down on pesticide exposure, realizing almost how impossible that is, giving their lives. I mean, that's really what organizers on the ground in these places, these clinics have come down to, which is trying to help people to minimize their exposure.
Right.
Because there's nothing.
And, you know, and on pesticides, I mean, the good news about pesticides, well, let me go back to Jose.
Sure.
Jose is an educator for the Chamacos Project, and he's a former farm worker himself, and he does these trainings, you know, every week, does multiple trainings, giving farm workers very, very simple but really useful and effective information about how they can reduce the amount of pesticides they and their children are exposed to. You know, really basic stuff like take off your shoes before you go in the house. You know, don't hug your kids until you change out of your work clothes. Real basic stuff. It's a great thing that Chamacos is doing for the people of the Salinas Valley. The hard part is for the good news on pesticides is you actually can reduce your exposure. You know, washing fruits and vegetables thoroughly, taking off you know, outer leaves of leafy greens, looking for organic produce when possible. All of that can actually reduce the amount of pesticides that you pick up on a daily basis. The hard part when you start looking at other chemicals is we don't necessarily know what's in that Tupperware container or in that plastic bottle that we drink from or that shower curtain you bring home. That's when it gets much tougher because you don't actually know what you're being exposed to. You know, and in the end of the day, I always tell people, because I don't just write about pesticides, it's probably not any one single chemical. It's that big assortment of chemicals that we're all exposed to every day, which, again, the EPA has not yet really figured out how to assess the health impacts of, you know, the multiple chemicals that all of us get exposed to every day.
Which is what you write about, which is why all these things you write about, whether it's plastics or this, are so connected.
Absolutely. Absolutely. The problems they pose are all very similar. The failure of the regulatory system to really protect us adequately.
Well, Susan Franklin, I want to thank you so much for this conversation today and the article, which we'll be linking to it on our website, Warning Signs: How Pesticides Harm the Young Brain, which you can find on the Nation website, which is also linked to it from our website. It's a pleasure to have you with us. Thank you so much.
Great. Thank you so much for having me.
The Mark Steiner Show and Soundbites are a production of the Center for Emerging Media, made possible in part by a grant from the Town Creek Foundation. Our producers are Mark Gunnery and Stephanie Mavronis. Our engineer at WEAA is Andre Melton. Our engineer at Public Radio Delmarva is Christopher Rank. To hear this show again, podcast any of our past shows, and find out information from the interviews we are doing on this program, please visit us on the web at steinershow.org. You can also listen to and download our podcasts on iTunes. For Public Radio, WEAA, 88.9 FM, the voice of the community, and for WSDL, 90.7 FM, and WSCL, 89.5 FM, Delmarva Public Radio, I'm Mark Steiner. Take care.